there's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life, if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is July the 3rd, 2014. Boom, ba boom, boom, boom. Yep. 4th of July for me, guys. I'll tell you why. My kiddo has to work on the 4th. We have this tradition we've started since we moved back. We blow a whole bunch of shit up here at the Spirko Homestead on the 4th of July. Today we will light up the sky on the 3rd of July. And I am off for the long weekend, like many of you will be starting tomorrow anyway. There'll be no TSP Friday, but we will have a bunch of fun today. Because I got a guy coming on the air in a bit named Sam Sampson. It's not a pseudonym, that is his real name. He is a Revolutionary War reenactor and part of the 5th Connecticut Regiment, which is an actual unit that existed during the Revolutionary War that was recreated as a reenactment unit in the 70s. And he's been with them for quite a while, not since the 70s, but quite a while. And they do reenactments on weekends several times a year. It's a really cool thing. And I didn't think of it when Dorothy booked this, but she hit a home run because what better to talk about the day before America's birthday than the revolution that was born before that day? Anyway, before I bring Sam on, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors. They do a lot to help take care of you. Sponsor of the day number one today is Survival Gear Bags. Yes, Survival Gear Bags. Survival Gear Bags is a company grown right out of the TSP community. Kelly Jandot, who is known as Cart Pusher on the forum, has a forum handle that's in the double digits. That's how long ago he joined our forum. He was in the fulfillment industry. And Kelly had access to a lot of different suppliers because of that. So he put together some group buys for members of the forum, said, hey, you know what? There's a lot of interest here. Maybe I could actually turn this into a business. He created SurvivalGearBags.com. Today that's run by Kelly and his family. A family-run business born in the Survival Podcast community with great gear and great bags to put that gear in. Check them out today, SurvivalGearBags.com. Next up today, Safe Castle Royal, the original Survival Podcast sponsor. The sponsor that was a sponsor when nobody was a sponsor. That's Safe Castle Royal. They were here long before anybody else was. They had their 5th year anniversary in January as a sponsor of this show. That's a ton of loyalty in the podcast community world. And folks, they have everything you can think of for your prepping needs. Check them out today at safecastle.com. They're just great guys. And hey, you know what? They have a discount buyers club. It's $49. You pay that one time, you get discounts on the stuff that they sell forever. Guess what, though? If you are a member of my support brigade, you get that for, dun-dun-dun, free. Yes, they give that away to you for free as a member of my MSB. That effectively makes your first year of MSB a dollar because it's $50 a year. On that note, guess what I'm doing? Boom, boom, boom. It's the 4th of July. We have to have a 4th of July sale. Everybody else does it. Why not us, too? I just really did think it was a good time to go ahead and run a quick sale for the MSB. Between now and Monday the 7th, just to make it run all the way through the weekend, because some people will not listen during this week because they're on vacation or whatever, I am doing the first year of MSB for $35. The discount code for that is 4JULY, and that's not spelled out. That's just the number 4, followed by JULY, all lowercase, when you sign up. You'll get $15 off your first year. If you want to pay by mail, just write it on the form and adjust accordingly. You want to pay by Bitcoin, email me at jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. I'll make arrangements for you to pay the discounted rate for Bitcoin. It's too much of a pain in the butt to set the discount up for. And you can become an MSB member for only $35. Military, law enforcement, Peace Corps, active duty and prior service, and first responders like EMTs, paramedics, and firefighters, all of you do qualify for a discount. And it's not quite the same price, but it's like $2 different. And you guys get your discounted price on renewals. So you may still want to just email me with service discount in the subject line. And When you do that, I'll respond back to you with your discount code. Please do that before, not after you join. All right, with that, let's get into the year that was the episode. It's quite a historic day today, but, you know, we are going far further back in time than the Revolutionary War today. We're setting the time machine all the way back to 1381. Surely things were much different in 1381, and they were, but not as much as you might think. Today I've chosen for us the Peasants' Revolt. Actually, no, I'm going to do the Jews and the Provost of Paris, because this ties into something I wanted to talk about yesterday. And you can read The Peasants' Revolt and King Richard's Love for 1381 at the tspwiki.com, where it's, again, tspwiki.com, where Alex Shrugged puts these great historical segments together for us. After King Charles the Wise revoked the hearth tax, which is a fundamental property tax, and then died, riots broke out as the French government tried to restore order and income to the government. To do that, the government is going to need some serious intermediate financing. And that means turning to the Jews, who understand banking. But some Frenchmen see opportunity in chaos and try to erase their debts by killing off the Jews who hold their loans. The provost of Paris, seeing the danger to the Jews and France's imminent financial collapse, places the Jews under protective custody. For this supreme act of Christian charity and common sense, the provost has been convicted and sentenced to life in prison, living on bread and water. He manages to escape and flee the city. From all of these things of people escaping prisons back in the day, it doesn't seem like they had a lot of security at these prisons. Anyway, my take by Alex Shrugged. This is a tricky subject because finance is considered a black art, even today. Who knows finance in the Middle Ages? The Lombards know it, but they're Italian. The Knights Templar knew it, but they were disbanded. So that leaves the Jews to work France's finances, but not everyone is seeing the big picture. So they're going for short-term gain. Controversial opinion. This is from Alex. To excuse their own violence against the Jews, these Christians have kidnapped Jewish babies and baptized them. To be fair to their faith, the Christians probably thought this was a good idea, but they wouldn't have forced it unless money was on the line in the first place. FYI, this is from Alex again. Alex Shrugged is Jewish, so he can comment on things Jewish. He can comment on Christianity with less authority because he studied it in college. He also feels perfectly comfortable talking about himself in third person. I love a little humor there at the end. Anyway, my take is, basically, what this is telling you is that the government in France in 1381 not only doesn't understand money, they know they don't understand money. Ha! I would like you to look to the halls of Congress and to the desk of the President of the United States. And I would like to ask you, now that Ron Paul's no longer in government, do you think any of those ass clowns up there that have inherited the legacy that we're about to celebrate tomorrow understand money at all? I don't think so. This is why I think that the government of France at this time was probably smarter than the government of the United States at this time. They knew what they didn't know. This makes me think of a saying by someone also from history, but far more recent history. Name was Samuel Clemens, wrote under the name of Mark Twain. You might have heard of him, but this was his statement on this concept. It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. I think a lot of times that our government does stupid things because they think they know something they don't. There's another quote, I don't know where it originally came from, but it also applies to that. And that is, never attribute to malice that which can be explained through incompetence. Those are my thoughts. Anyway, with that, I'm almost ready to get into the main part of today's show, but I wanted to let you know that our good buddy and my friend, an absolute lunatic nut job, Paul Wheaton, has some cool stuff available right now on his website. I'm going to preface this with saying that I'm going to tell you about one thing on there that it says you can buy, and I can't figure out how to buy it. So if you want to buy it and you can't figure out how to buy it It's a forum thread, so ask Paul to tell you how to buy the dadgone thing. But he just did a World Domination gardening DVD that covers earthworks and pond building and stuff like that. He's got those there. He's got the wood-burning stoves DVDs that he has out. He's got some that are basically like opened and used and then repackaged and a little dinged up, but the discs work good. He's got them at like half price. He's got the permaculture playing cards, and my name is on there. I'm also hidden on the Hugelkultur card, which is the ace of clubs, and I'm on their the bonus card. And he's got a 32 gig jump drive with 70 of his best, the best TSP podcasts on it, plus a video I sent, and a whole bunch of his podcasts on there, all in this one little cool USB jump drive. I'm also listed as the supreme executive producer with Bacon, Cheese, and Sparkles on the Wood Burning Stoves DVD series, which I'm proud to be there, but I told him I didn't feel like a bacon sparkly kind of guy. So I am acknowledged in a different and more fitting way, I think, on the World Domination DVDs for helping him get the funding to get those things going. So there's some really cool stuff that he has available at his forum. Again, I couldn't figure out how to order the one thing, but the DVDs that he has available for this World Domination stuff. It's a four DVD set on earthworks, pond building, and a lot of other cool stuff. And I've seen the first two now because I have the downloads of it, and they're awesome. This is like probably the best thing Paul's ever done. So you might want to consider checking those out if you're looking for more permaculture content. Anyway, with that, I am ready to get in the main topic of today's show, but before I bring Sam on, I want to kind of set the stage for you about what we're going to talk about here. Again, Sam's a reenactor of the Revolutionary War. And that means that they dress up in period clothing, they carry period reenacted muskets, they go out and reenact skirmishes and battles, they set up the tents, the camps, just like the soldiers did during the Revolutionary War. And as we go through this, you're going to hear some stuff that we go back and forth on with some just thoughts of what it must have been like to be there, face that battle at that time. You understand what I mean? To actually put yourself in there, and how during these reenactments, right, you know you're safe. You're out there playing around, firing just nothing but black powder up in the air and having a good time. But you do get in the mindset of what it must have been like to be a soldier, and frankly, you're far more well-fed and far more comfortable and have far more resources at your disposal than they did, and you're out there doing it for a weekend versus until it's over. And you'll hear some statistics from the Revolutionary War that we'll talk about during this, but I'd like to review them with you now on the eve of our nation's birthday, and I want to drive a few points home about how much we've lost in reality from what was given to us by great men. The numbers I'm going to share with you are official, but they're not necessarily accurate. There could be far more people dead and wounded because, you know, record keeping wasn't quite what it is today. But the combat deaths from the Revolutionary War are lower than I think most people would imagine. 8,000 is the official number. And when you see a perfectly round number like that, you know it's an estimate, okay? The total number of deaths during the Revolutionary War on the American side, 25,000. Most of the others died of starvation, disease, and starvation, disease, and ill treatment in prisoner of war camps by the British. The total wounded is about another 25,000. So about 25,000 killed, 25,000 wounded in some way. And being wounded at the time was not like being wounded today, where they, you know, medevac you with a helicopter to a MASH unit, and you know, it was a bad thing to be seriously wounded. And many of the wounded probably did die and died far enough down the road from complications that they weren't officially listed as a death from combat. And again, these numbers are probably fairly low, and they don't take into account the number of civilians that died, which is probably nowhere near the numbers of deaths that occur as collateral damage in later wars like the Civil War and World War I and World War II. But there was a great loss of life on the civilian side, and there was certainly a great loss of life due to, you know, supplies being unavailable and things like that, and disease. There was a huge smallpox epidemic. We'll talk a little bit about that when I get Sam on during the Revolutionary War. And this is what the men, dare I say boys, who gave this nation its opportunity to be the shining city on the hill, did to give us that. And you should think about that when you're having fun and blowing stuff up this weekend. That it's not just about getting a day off, having fun, blowing stuff up, and making hot dogs. That's what that's really about, is the willingness of farm boys and young, you know, stewards and smiths and things like that to mount up, move out, and fight for the independence of a nation that had yet to exist. So before I bring Sam on, what I want to do is I want to play for you a song that I helped to write, and it does lead up to the current day, but it starts out right in the time and place that we're going to talk about. The musician that you'll hear, if you've never heard this song, is a gentleman named Greg Yoes, and again, he and I wrote this song together, and this is a song for the 4th of July.
My family, when the shot heard round the world, called up those British bastards that put me to the sword. Well, I died a lonely subject, a king and monarchy. Yeah, I'm the first American who made this country free. What have you done with my country? What have you done with the founding truth? I gave my life. Pay me. Well, I hit that beach a running with an M1 in my hand. Before I got to cover, I was face down in the sand. Well, I'm proud to die on D-Day, and I'd do it all again. The time has shown me death and war breeds politics and sin. What have you done with my country? Done with the white picket fence. I gave my life so you could be free. And this is how, yeah, this is how you repay me. Yeah, I keep looking down, see it all go wrong. My blood mixed with dirt that the Yankees call their home. My blood was spilled for nothing. You people aren't free. And all the rights I gave my life for just a memory. What have you done with my country? What have you done with the God of men? I gave my life so you could be free. And this is how, yeah, this is how you repay me. Looking back, just the other side, they're pulling for us all who live free because they died. To those of you who've turned your back on the land in which you live, when you go to meet your maker, what answer will you give? What have you done with my country? What have you done with the founding truth? I gave my life. Yeah, this is how you repay me. What have you done with my country? What have you done with the founding truth? I gave my life so you could be free. And this is how. Yeah, this is how. Yeah, this is how. Yeah, this is how. Yeah, this is how. You repay me.
That should hit us all. And I do want to point out that my greatest contribution to the writing of this song was the last verse. That was really the verse that I wrote. Because I felt there had to be a reckoning. There had to be an accountability to those who have squandered this nation. That's why I do what I do. Because I do believe a reckoning eventually will come. I don't know if it'll be in this life or if the next one. But I do know that people cannot squander liberty at the rate that this nation has without eventually paying a big ass bill for it. And whether that bill comes in the form of an economic catastrophe due to our reckless spending, or it comes from the boot of a tyrant upon your throat, and you, trust me, will not care when that boot is on your throat, whether it's a left or a right boot, or whether some other way, I don't know, but there will be a reckoning. And sooner or later, the words of Thomas Jefferson may play out, and the Tree of Liberty may have to be watered once again with both the blood of patriots and tyrants. And I believe the only way that we will ever not have to face that level of a reckoning is for individuals to begin to reclaim their individual liberty and their community-level liberty right now, and start rebuilding before the collapse. That's what TSP has been all about. And please think about that in your own life as you do enjoy the 4th of July. And with that, let me bring on our special guest today, Mr. Sam Sampson. Sam, hey man, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Thanks, welcome.
Hey, we're going to talk about reenacting today, and specifically reenacting Revolutionary War era stuff. But before we do that, can you just tell people a little bit about yourself, like what your professional background is and how you ended up as a Revolutionary War reenactment person? Like, how do you get there from wherever you were?
Well, I grew up in Connecticut, you know, very historical state. And close by me was Nathan Hale's homestead. And everybody kind of knows Nathan Hale's background of being, you know, tried as a traitor, hung, all that stuff. And I just went to his house one day, and they had a reenactment going on, and it seemed kind of interesting, so I kind of just talked to the guys, and they said, you know, try it out. Come try it out for a weekend. And I did it. I really wanted to just shoot the musket.
Okay.
You know? And I thought that's all I really would want to do, is just shoot the musket. And once you're actually in it and shooting the musket and doing the battles, it's definitely a heart-stopping experience. It feels very real when you're out there.
But it takes you back in time, too. Like, it gives you a sense of place that you can't get from reading a book.
Oh, absolutely. Like, you know, you go there on a Friday night, usually set up camp, and you're in your civilian clothes. You go to bed, you put on your 18th century wardrobe, and you wake up, and it's, you know, you're back in 1786 or whatever year you're portraying that weekend.
Can you talk about, you know, because I imagine there's a lot, because you're out living like you were in that time. You're not just recreating it for 5 minutes. You're doing this like over a weekend or something like that. And with that and living that lifestyle, I imagine there's a lot of, I guess what we would call today, primitive skills that come up. So what are some of the skills you can obtain that would pertain to, like, you know, the modern survival movement from reenactment?
Oh, yeah. Well, I hear you, you know, your call-in shows, everybody, oh, how do you do this without electricity? How do you do that without electricity? You know, this, they lived everything they did was without electricity. So, yeah, you're living that lifestyle on the weekend, and everything pretty much. There's people that do blacksmiths, whitesmiths, a tinsmith, Weaving, sewing, cooking over an open fire, that's pretty important. Hearth cooking, cooking with cast iron, riding horses. Lots of people also do like some Native American stuff, so there's all kinds of herbal remedies and things like that, shaman stuff. Shaving with a straight razor, that's one.
Oh, you guys do that too. Wow, I didn't even ever think of that. So, I mean, I guess it's like anything that you would have to get by with for a period of time. In that period of time, you're going to have to figure out how they did it.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, it sounds really interesting. Can you give us, like, walk us through then a day of a typical day of reenacting? What's it like?
Yeah, usually wake up to, the horns and the parade. You know, they usually wake everybody up with some drums. And that's usually around 9 or 10 o'clock. And then, usually it'll open up to the public, and they'll start strolling in, and you have demonstrations usually from 10 to noon about. And those will be the cooking thing, sewing demonstrations, pottery making, blacksmith, whitesmith. And then usually there's always a battle. That's around 1, 2, get everybody interested. Those can last hour about. And then some more demonstrations usually after. Then it'll close to the public, and that's when everybody kind of starts drinking, hanging out, having fun.
Cool, man. So that sounds awesome. A name that I see in your notes here is, before we do that, you said everybody starts drinking, having fun. What are some of the, maybe some of the activities going on that are, you know, unique to a reenactment?
A lot of people, there's a lot of songs, like sea shanties that people sing, especially after a few drinks, everybody's singing like crazy. And then there's a lot of shenanigans that go on with, between the American troops and the British troops, you know, stealing things, putting things in crazy places, hiding things.
That makes me think I was in the Army. We, at one time, when I was in our advanced training, we stole the guidon. For those of you that wouldn't know, the flag basically that, you know, falls at the front of the formation and represents the commander of the unit, we stole their guidon, and we actually broke it into three parts. We didn't break it, but it was designed to come apart. We took the tip off, the flag off, and the pole apart, and we hid it in three different places. And it was – so it's something soldiers really do to each other. You mentioned, like, the British. So obviously if you're going to do this reenactment – you have to have both sides, or it looked kind of weak if you guys were just shooting at, I don't know, trees. So the people that play the British, are they part of your group that just, like, on this day and point play that, or are they in a permanent role but they're part of your group, or are they part of another group that you collaborate with?
Well, everybody's part of usually a group like the Brigade of the American Revolution or the Continental Line. But everybody has their own individual group. The British,
it's
like
military. You got a big unit, a smaller unit, okay.
Yeah, yep. Everybody has like their, and they're usually descendant upon whatever troop was around at that time, you know. They all have some historical significance.
Okay. So the guys that play the Brits, man, we think of those as be the bad guys of the revolution. What motivates them to take that side? How do you get a guy in a reenactment to take the side that eventually is going to lose?
Well, they won most of the battles, so.
That's true.
And their uniforms look great. I think that's part of the British is looking good, because their uniforms are perfect. Everything's shiny. Everything looks really good. I mean, It's a little intimidating, too, when you see couple hundred redcoats marching up the hill with shiny bayonets coming after you.
So are there more guys that play the Brits than the Americans in your group anyway?
In our group, we have quite a big group. It's about even with the Brits.
Okay.
So it's kind of nice even battle usually, but sometimes it can be very one-sided.
Because it depends on who shows up, which isn't far off of the truth, right, of the history. with the kind of disorganized, pulled together militia units of the time, that was often the case, is the commander would, you know, have to work with whoever showed up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And with crappy equipment, you know, you didn't bring your best musket, you know. Most of the stuff that was appointed to the soldiers was just leftovers from the French Indian War.
Huh.
Hardly worked.
So you guys try to recreate that too, to have equipment that's not quite perfect looking and things like that, and to, you know, to demonstrate the actual way things were?
Yeah, our group has a very ragtag group of guys. Everything's kind of, you know, put together here and there, sewed together. Doesn't look very perfect. Some guys don't have a jacket. Some guys do. Some guys have a patched up jacket. Very authentic, probably.
Yeah. So one of the names I see in your notes here is a guy named Joseph Plum Martin. I have a feeling he must have been important to the group you're reenacting, or the area, or something like that.
He's pretty much important to every reenactor, because he joined the Connecticut Militia at 15 years old, and served for about 3 months in the militia. Then he just decided to join the actual Continental Army, and he served in the Continental Army to the end of the war. So he has experience throughout the whole war, and he wrote a memoir about all his, you know, the actions that he took, and he gives you the perspective of a private more than, you know, we always hear about what George Washington did or what, you know, Horatio Gates did. We never really hear about the common soldier, and that's his book, is all about the common soldier, what they would suffer through.
I think that's very interesting, and I think part of the reason that we have less of that perspective from that time period is there were quite a few people, you know, of the general population, I guess, that still weren't real hip on reading and writing.
Oh, well, you know, some of them, if you were kind of born into a little bit of affluence, you learned how to read, write. But, yeah, if you were a common farmer, you didn't really have an education.
Hmm.
It was pretty much homeschooled, and then you became an apprentice and
did whatever it was that your trade was going to be, I guess. Because, I mean, we have a lot more of that. The reason I say that, I never really thought about it until you brought that up, but we have a lot more of that perspective from, like, World War I and World War II than we do of the Revolutionary War or the Civil War. And it may have a lot to do with literacy. And I think that a lot of times, from my understanding of history from those periods, from the Civil War back to, you know, the just before the Revolution, there were actually a lot of people who could read okay, but they weren't really good at writing. So they learned enough to understand words and things like that, and they could read them, but they didn't spend a lot of time behind a desk, so they didn't really know how to write.
True. I mean, these guys knew how to read Latin, but they couldn't write English.
Yeah, that's another thing I never really thought of. So when you guys are out there, are you guys, like, sleeping in, like, so not just tents, but period tents, canvas tents, that type of thing?
Yeah, we are sleeping in a canvas tent. It's probably about, I would say, 6 feet by 8 feet, maybe 6 foot by seven, kind of small. And when we're out there, we're sleeping one person to a tent. A lot of people have cots and things that they bring from modern stuff. But, you know, during the Revolutionary War, those soldiers actually had four people to one of those tents. So you had four people crammed in this little tiny tent that one person barely fits in. And the highest ranking officer would sleep in the back of the tent, so he didn't get climbed over after. Anytime anybody had to do something, you had to climb over the other three guys to get out.
Sure.
So the lowest ranking guy was the last guy in the tent. He got climbed over all night.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're probably on a bedroll if they were lucky. So you guys do bring a little bit of modern comfort to things, but it seems like because of the fact that, like, that stuff's inside the tent, the appearance to the observer that comes to see what's going on is extremely historically accurate.
Yeah, we try to keep at least one tent pretty historically accurate, and we'll keep the flaps open you know, all the other tents usually are closed so people don't see your cot or your headlamp or whatever you got lying around your clothes.
Sure, sure. So I'm looking on your website right now, and I'm seeing a lot of women there, but they're all in dresses and, you know, bonnets and stuff like that. And I've seen some kids, too. What role do they play in all of this?
The women are called, they're usually called distaff, and they actually follow the army.
I'm sorry, I missed that. What are they usually called?
Distaff.
Okay.
D-I-S-T-A-F-F.
Okay.
And they would follow, you know, a woman would follow her husband into battle and set up camp. And they would, or if she was a widow, sometimes they would do it to make money. They would wash clothing or sew things for the soldiers. So the women played a pretty big, large role. There's even a couple of women who disguised themselves as soldiers. There was a woman, Deborah Sampson, from Massachusetts. She disguised herself as a soldier and fought for 18 months until she was injured.
Hmm.
There's another lady, Molly Pitcher. Her husband was on the cannon crew. She saw him faint, probably due to heat exhaustion. So she just runs out and takes the spot, starts loading the cannon.
Yeah, there was definitely a role played by women in the Revolutionary War beyond what we commonly think of. And there, I think there's actually been several stories of women who disguise themselves as males to take part in combat. Sometimes that may have simply been because at least you got fed and some money, and they may have lost a husband or something. But I also see you got these kiddos here. So how do you involve children? And like, you know, we had people serving in militias at 14 and 15. What age do you require of youngsters before they kind of put on the three-pointed hat and get a musket? How do you handle the kids in this and get them involved and excited?
Yeah, you have to be 16 to use the musket. That's
okay.
One of the rules. The kids usually, there's lots of games that they play. There's all kinds of little games. You know, they have they had cards back then that kids play. They had little toy soldiers. A lot of the kids, you know, just run around and play hide and seek or go fish in the creeks.
Sure, sure. I mean, you put kids out in the country, they generally figure out something to do with themselves. I'm just kind of looking at some of the age differences here, and like, you know, some of the kids you can see starting to be part of the unit in some way or shape or another. On the muskets, I guess you're just firing what, like patch and powder?
We do blanks.
It's okay.
Mainly you just dump the black powder down your musket and fire it.
So it's okay. So that is that partly why then where I see the lines firing, the muskets are always slightly angled upward?
Well, that's actually you would
safety thing.
The muskets were incredibly inaccurate. So you would never really actually aim at somebody. One of the commands is, you know, it's not take aim. Everybody says, oh, take aim. It was actually take sight.
Okay. Because
you really were just looking in that direction and firing in that direction because you weren't trying to hit a precise point because the musket was so inaccurate that you couldn't hit it.
You're shooting at a formation, not an individual.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're shooting a wall of musket balls at them instead of just one or two.
So with the angles, would commanders of the day at times command an angle based on the range? Like archers would command an angle based on range in you know, medieval times?
Yep, exactly.
Huh. Well, that makes perfect sense. It's something we don't really think about today because we can put a round where we want it, you know, out hundreds of meters. Even with iron sights, we can do that. You know, they train us in the military now. We shoot at 500, 550 meters with iron sights, and we're able to hit man-sized targets at that range. And it just wasn't done with the equipment these guys were using.
I mean, yeah, your musket is accurate to 50 yards, maybe.
So
even then, it's still not very accurate.
The clothing, where does that come from? Do you guys make your own? Is there like a place you buy it from? How do you come up with this period clothing?
Most of the people make their own. I had to sew my own. They usually just give you the pattern and the pieces and not much direction. And here you go, sew a jacket. But there are some websites you can go to where you can buy the stuff pre-made. But, you know, we're trying to learn skills, so selling as a skill.
Would the average soldier at the time made their, like for a militia, made their clothing?
Oh, yeah. Most of the times the people would make their clothing back then.
Huh. Well, I didn't know
that. The soldier was responsible for his clothing and taking care of it, fixing patches.
Huh. Another thing I see in your notes here is the Von Steuben drill. What's that?
Okay, so yeah, the Americans were losing almost every battle, and they get encamped in the Valley Forge. Everybody's heard of the stories of how bad it was, and you follow the soldiers by their bloody footprints. You know, dysentery was everywhere. So Von Steuben comes in. He was a Prussian-born, and he kind of got kicked out of his German town. And he comes to America, and he volunteers without pay to help the U.S. cause. And he did lots of things, like install sanitation. He changed the camp layouts. He did a lot of stuff, just basically little things that helped in a big way. But the biggest thing he did was he taught the American soldiers who had no idea how to fight with bayonets. He trained them. What he did was he trained like a model company. He took about 120 men, and he trained them as best he could to use the bayonet. And then he took each one of those 120 men was assigned another 120 men, and they had to teach them how to, you know, fight with the bayonets. And for the first battle they come out of Valley Forge is Battle of Stony Point, and they become victorious. They push them out, and they with bayonet fighting that they actually start winning.
So how do you guys use that today? Do you guys, so then is the drill the reenactment of that training?
Yes, we actually followed Von Steuben's. He wrote a manual, and today's military uses the same manual pretty much. All that stuff stems from his manual that he wrote. You know, taking up your arms, how to stand, how to hold your firelock, how to shoot it, all the different sequences, how, you know, that's all written out in steps.
When you're doing this and you realize the close quarters of combat, the standing in formation, standing in line, face-to-face, head-to-head type of warfare, because we always hear about how the U.S. fought an unconventional war, and we did and we didn't. We had times where we met on the battlefield in more of a conventional war of the time, and then we had different tactics that were used, but there were times when it was standing toe-to-toe, bayonet-to-bayonet, line-against-line, column-against-column. When you stand in that type of situation, do you think back to what must have been like for the person really doing it, how hard it must be for a soldier to have that discipline to stand in a formation like that?
It must have been incredibly hard, especially, I mean, there's so much smoke, there's people yelling, there's cannons going off, you can't hear anything. It must have been so incredibly hard to just focus and just stay there, you know, without running away.
And I guess they had to have enough confidence built in by command that, as crazy as it sounded, if you were in a war like this, your best chance of survival was to be in a cohesive unit and win the day.
Yeah. And you had to work together. It would be impossible to win without it.
Do you guys bring any... Go ahead.
You know, it wasn't just you. It was your group. You know, there was other generals, so it's other columns of men, other troops. It's working together throughout the whole group.
And if one doesn't do what it's expected to do by the others, the whole strategic plan falls apart. And I think the days of Von Steuben, that was a big part of the problem. Even if you had good commanders that knew what they were doing, if all your components of the battle didn't have that type of quality of command, and the commander of the one group expected that the other would hold a line or flank or what have you, or whatever maneuver they would do, or stand even, and they didn't, and the commander made the right decision, he ended up uncovered and all alone. And that was probably a big part of why we lost so many of the early battles.
Oh, yeah. I mean, nobody really had a lot of military experience, you know, for the first few battles. Washington was the most experienced, and he really didn't have that much.
No, he really didn't. It was more of a conceptual experience than an engaging experience that Washington had.
He had the Battle of Fort Necessity was pretty much the only major battle he had before that.
Yeah. So, in this day and age, if you got hit with a ball, you were in bad shape, but you weren't necessarily dead. And medicine of the time was primitive, to say the least. Do you guys get into any of that, like how battlefield injuries were treated or what was done with the dead or anything like that?
Yeah, we have a surgeon usually. They'll give a demonstration, you know, in the morning and afternoon of showing what would happen. He has all his surgeon tools, and he would show how they would pull a vein out to cauterize it and shove it back in. And,
ugh.
You know. Yeah, some of the tools are just so primitive, and they're scary looking.
But it was what they had and what they had to deal with. I guess that brings a certain air of realism and reality to it as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have the wooden stick that you would bite on. You know?
You know, I've heard that the stories of, you know, biting the bullet in the Civil War were more myth than reality. But I've been to some of the battlefield museums in Tennessee, and the balls with the teeth marks in them do exist.
Yeah.
And to me, that was one of the most horrific realities. To see something like that, to understand something like that.
Yeah. I mean, just seeing the tools alone are just quite scary. Just, they're so primitive. You know, there's like a vein puller. It's really just disturbing to see some of the stuff.
Yeah. You also have in your notes here, Benedict Arnold, hero as well as traitor. I think that if there's a name that's more synonymous with being a traitor than Benedict Arnold, it's Judas. And those are probably the two names used interchangeably by people when calling someone a traitor. But can you talk about how he was both a traitor and a hero before that?
Yeah, sure. So before the trading, you know, before West Point and all that, he was a general, and he was actually, Washington said he was the best general out there. He was very different from the other generals who would stand back and give commands. He was the guy on his horse out there leading everybody. He was the first one out the gate, you know, he's the first one there. He almost conquered Canada, which was, he went up to Quebec. He almost fought that, but he was captured and escaped. Then he took on a whole fleet, much bigger fleet at Lake Champlain, and he won that battle. And then he comes to Saratoga, this is the major, you know, this is where he gets his fame. Horatio Gates in Saratoga kept insisting that he wanted to wait, and Benedict Arnold is the other general there, and he says, I'm not waiting, I'm taking my guys, and we're just going now. And he just takes his troops, and he just goes out, and he goes right into battle. He overtakes the redoubt, and they win the battle. But during the battle, he gets injured. He gets his horse gets shot up from under him, and he falls and he breaks his leg. So he basically renders him a cripple. You know, he walks with a cane the rest of his life after that. And he kind of feels disrespected because Horatio Gates goes and tells everybody that he was the one that was responsible for going in and attacking them, and I'm the one that was the best, you know. So Benedict Arnold kind of takes offense to that. And so that's one thing. You know, then he asked for money because he was never paid. One thing, constant thing, these people were never paid the money they were promised. So he meets with John Andre, who, through a woman, they somehow meet through this lady. And they come up with the plan of giving up West Point. And that's where the trading begins, is he gives up, well, he doesn't, you know, Andre gets caught because he's wearing his British clothes, so he looks British. He kind of sticks out like a sore thumb, and people question him, and he's got all the plans for West Point in his boot. So he was pretty much caught red-handed. And right in the papers, it talks all about Benedict Arnold, and there he is sitting at West Point. He gets word they actually send a letter to Arnold first saying, we caught this guy. And he's like, oh, God, they caught my, you know, my informant. He takes off running. And Washington arrives probably, like, within hours of Benedict Arnold leaving to find the whole place abandoned. Everybody standing down, muskets standing down. And here is West Point, our most critical point on the Hudson River, abandoned. And he's furious with Arnold, who fled to be with the British. And then, you know, the British actually didn't like him either because they thought he was a traitor. So he joins them, and they're kind of like, well, you were a traitor, so we're not going to give you any major battles here. Go do whatever. They don't really give him any type of assignments or anything. They don't even give him any troops.
He did command some troops in, I think, Virginia, but it was a small group.
Yeah, it was a very small group. He actually came back to Connecticut, too, and there was a small major little battle that happened in New London where he came in and he kind of basically massacred the whole town. Burnt everything, killed everybody, women, children.
And I guess the final fate of Arnold was dying in England.
Yeah. And he actually asked to have his Continental Army uniform on when he was buried.
Really? Was that request honored?
Yes, they buried him in his Continental uniform.
Well, there's some historical fact I did not know at all. So that's quite interesting. Now, when we look at the casualties of the Revolutionary War, I believe the number is estimated at, like, total killed in service around 25,000 on the side of the colonies. But like 17 or so were either died in prison camps of the British or died of disease or starvation. When you do these reenactments, do you kind of get the understanding of why that would have been the case? I mean, you're well fed, obviously. You're doing this for historical purposes, but also to enjoy yourself and have fun. But just when you're in the period reenactment, do you kind of get the understanding, like, well, hell, if I was out here in a battlefield, you know, miles from home, thin supply lines, as ragtag as this was, there'd be a lot of potential for these types of things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, disease was probably ran rampant everywhere. Especially, you know, latrines, nobody knows how to set it. You know, nowadays we have a, you know, a water pig comes out. We have all the little porta potties set up. You know, back then they just dug a hole. They drank the water right from who knows where. I'm sure disease was rampant.
Then there was a major smallpox epidemic that ran rampant during the war. I mean, that's one of the most interesting period things I've ever seen come out of, like, you know, TV, HBO type thing was the miniseries John Adams. And
yeah, that was great.
Yeah, especially like the first three episodes were fabulous, and then as it got into his later life, it got a little you know, you see that you know, the smallpox epidemic come through and hit his own family. And so it didn't just hit the soldiers. It helped the families at home. And then, you know, disease doesn't care if you're British or colonial American or whatever. It just runs rampant. And, you know, there was there was like a way that they inoculated for smallpox at the time, but it didn't seem like a great idea. They basically took like the pus from a dead person, smallpox, and like shoved it into the arm of a living person.
That didn't seem like it worked really
effectively, but I guess it gave it more of a topical infection and less of a respiratory, so you developed the resistance. And I mean, when I watch stuff like that, I think to myself, my God, how hard was life at the time, really?
That's one thing. I mean, these soldiers, just people in general back then, were just so much tougher. You know, we have it pretty easy nowadays. It was just a harder life.
Yeah, and hard lives do make hard individuals. That's the case. I mean, I think that one of the other stories I remember, I think, and this was the War of 1812, was, I guess it was Madison who was president at the time, running around Washington during the evacuation on his horse. giving commands and overseeing the evacuation of Washington. Washington was overrun and burned. And thinking, there isn't a president in modern day that even if the Secret Service allowed it, would do something like that. It just doesn't, like, that mentality just doesn't seem to exist in our society anymore.
And yeah, not at all. I mean, we're a bunch of weaklings compared to what she said were. I have this thing at my desk that talks about, a modern soldier, and it talks about the M4 rifle can fire 700 shots per second or minute. And then it gives, the Revolutionary War soldier what he had in his bag of tricks. And, you have a musket that fires 4 shots a minute if you're really good.
Yeah.
40 yards max, 50 yards max.
Yeah, and then, thinking about, lines charging into cannon fire, they could have been shooting anything from, cannon shells and balls to canister shot. That's another thing that, like, the first time I ever held a piece of canister shot in my hand, I was kind of blown away by how heavy it was, how hard it was, and how big it was. It's like a giant ball bearing. And things like that had to be absolutely horrific to face.
Yeah, I can't imagine, what a cannonball would do to a person.
So I remember, one of the, and I know there was a lot of theatrics in it, and some real ridiculous level of capability portrayed, but movies like Mel Gibson did The Patriot, other than the amazing superpowered guy that can, kill 27 people with a tomahawk or whatever. The overall way that some of those battles were, as a reenactor, do you look at that and think there's a lot of truth to that? Like, is that at least historically somewhat accurate?
Yeah, the battles seem pretty accurate. I mean, they were on a grander scale than most of the stuff we do and see, because it just was more, it's thousands of people compared to hundreds.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely as real as they make it out to be.
How do you guys get more members? Does it just people kind of find you? Do spectators tend to become members, or what would you say your average turnout is on the side of the people that are just there to observe?
There's a lot more people that just go to observe. We try to recruit people because there's not a lot of people in the hobby. So any opportunity we get, we're trying to recruit new people, especially young people, because most of the people are kind of older in the hobby.
Yeah.
Any chance we can get a 16-year-old kid, he'd be perfect. That's what that's what was really out there.
Yeah, it was 16, 17, 18-year-old kids that were doing the bulk of this stuff, especially as line soldiers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how involved do observers get? Do they just kind of hang out, or do they at least start to get more interaction with you guys as the day goes by? And how often do you do this? Is this an every weekend thing? Is this a once a month thing? Is there a season?
There is kind of a season, but I mean, it usually is summertime, most of the stuff. Because
okay.
A lot of the times, you try to go on the same day that the battle happened or the same weekend. Try to have some historical significance.
I got you. And the summer was battle time back then. They didn't do a whole lot of fighting in the middle of winter.
Yeah. And I probably do about 6 or 7 a year. Not too many.
Okay.
Not too bad.
So this isn't like an every week thing, because I was going, that might be part of your recruiting problem, because, just getting free from the wife, every other weekend or something is difficult for some. So that sounds kind of cool. Before I actually go there, your unit is based on an actual historical unit, and I guess all of these groups are, they tie their roots back to a real unit. Could you give people a little bit of a history of your unit?
My unit is the 5th Connecticut Regiment. They were present for the battles of Monmouth, which was pretty much a major battle in New Jersey. And there was some historical significance to some of the people. you know, a lot of people haven't heard of the people in the group. Colonel Bradley was the general, I mean, the colonel of our group. He was the leader. And they were encamped at Valley Forge. They also encamped in Connecticut during the winter. But they didn't have a lot of major battle, you know, not a lot of the little battles they were part of, but they weren't part of any of the major battles that people have heard of.
So a lot of skirmishes and things like that.
Yeah. A lot of the battles were skirmishes here and there. And
how did you decide that this was the group you wanted to be part of? Was it just the first one you saw? Was it just the closest one to you? Was there something about it that kind of hooked you and said, these are the guys I want to be with?
What hooked me on these guys were everybody else was kind of, there was like the first one I went to, there was probably about five or six groups there. But this group in particular, they were singing songs. They seemed to be having the most fun.
Mm.
So I was like, I want to be in the one with having the most fun.
Is there like some component of let's have fun beyond the period, like, you know, cooking out, barbecuing in ways that maybe over the weekend that maybe you know those guys didn't do? Or is that just limited to like a little bit of stuff you were talking about in the tent?
Yeah, there's really, when we're in the event, there isn't much modern big like cooked out stuff. The group does hang out a lot, you know,
yeah,
outside of events.
Gotcha.
So there is a lot of camaraderie there.
So is this mostly like a Northeastern phenomenon? Are there groups like this all over? I mean, there was zero Revolutionary War activity in Texas where I'm at, right? So it doesn't really fit. You know, there might be some Civil War and reenactment stuff going around here. Is it largely regional? Is there any kind of national cohesive organization that all these groups are part of? Or is it independently run like fiefdoms? Or how does it work?
The Brigade of the American Revolution is kind of, they oversee everything. They're kind of the main group. But there's groups up and down the whole East Coast from South Carolina all the way up to Maine. But, yeah, most of the stuff is East Coast, especially the Red War stuff, because that's kind of where it all happened.
Like, kind of out of a left field thing here for you, the group of guys I know that do a lot to tell at least parts of the history of the American Revolution, but do it in a different way with modern firearm training is Appleseed. Are a lot of your guys that are involved in that, you know, also guys that have maybe been to an Appleseed shoot? Is there any kind of collaboration between the Revolutionary War veterans that run society that runs Appleseed and what you guys do? Or are you like totally devoid of each other and barely aware of each other's existence?
No, some people do the Appleseed stuff. Yes, they do. I haven't never done it myself, but I know some people do.
That's one of those things I want to do so bad. Just I got to make time, and every decision involves some time suck in this world today. They just seem really cool, and this stuff seems cool too. So, but yeah, I guess it is highly regional. I probably wouldn't be able to find much Revolutionary War reenactment in Dallas. But for those that are in, you know, from let's say the Carolinas up, where most of the stuff actually went on, how do they learn more about not just your group, but you know, what might be in their area if they're not near you?
I would go to the Brigade of the American Revolution. Usually has like a events list or a schedule of things that are going to happen. Also, there's another group called the Continental Line. They have a schedule, too, of events.
Okay, I'll make sure that I have both of those in the show notes. I'm actually Googling it right now, Continental Line, to make sure I don't forget when we hang up to put those in there. So I'll put your unit, and your unit, your website is what, 5cr.org?
Yep.
So that just kind of predisposes a question there. Is there, do you guys do any kind of, like, beyond the reenactments, any type of historical preservation? Is there any type of a charity component organization to this, any kind of fundraising? Or is it like, this is what we do, this is our contribution, here's how things went down?
Yeah, we don't really do a lot of, we do a lot of stuff for historical societies.
Okay.
But, you know, most of the stuff is usually battle-oriented on a day that it has some historical, you know, like the battle, reenactment of the Battle of Lexington and Concord. Or
okay, gotcha. Gotcha. So look, I want to just take back to something we sort of covered already before we wrap up here with understanding like a timeline thing of this. So we went through like a typical day, but I guess like let's say we look at a full weekend. Is it like you set up on Friday, do your reenactment Saturday, do another one Sunday, and then go home, or just party Saturday night, wake up Sunday morning, everybody leaves? I mean, how what's the whole totality of an event?
Yeah, most events are 2 days. You get there Friday night, or some people get there early Thursday, you know, and try to set up even earlier. And you have the battle 2 days. You have the events for 2 days, and then go home around Sunday, 4 or 5 o'clock.
Gotcha. Okay. So you do reenactment for 2 full days.
Oh yeah. Okay. You're there for a whole weekend.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Now, do people in your groups have like characters that they're portraying or ranks they're portraying? Like this guy's a private, this guy's a sergeant, that type of thing. And other than in the reenactment, does that mean anything to anybody?
We do have people that portray certain people. There's a guy from New Jersey, I believe, that plays Washington. He does a very good job.
Okay.
And there's usually somebody portraying, depending on what event it is, somebody portraying, you know, some historical significant person there.
I meant more in your units, like in your own group. If you have a line of soldiers, is there anybody that fills the role of like the line level NCO, or do you guys just all kind of line up and do your thing?
No, we do have an NCO, usually a sergeant.
Okay.
He'll take command and he'll give us orders.
Is that something that like rotates through different people do it? Or that's what I'm saying. It's kind of, is there any informal seniority in your group itself? Like Jim's been here forever, so that's what he does, or is it, you know, anybody could do that on any given day or what have you?
But you have to kind of know a little bit before you can do it, because there's a lot of the, you know, the nomenclature and the movements are very
okay.
difficult, especially because the sergeant always is looking at the troops. He's facing them. So if he tells you, you know, to turn left, he wants you to turn right the way he's seeing it, you know?
Sure.
So he's got to think opposite. Always.
But once a person gets some experience, that is a role like somebody can do.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to get at is I've seen some of the Civil War stuff where like everybody's ranked and it kind of has at least a little trickle through to the after hours things, like this guy's sergeant and this guy's corporal and this guy's private and this guy's a lieutenant. It seems like a lot less formal. It's just we need somebody that knows what they're doing to play that role on that day.
We do have kind of a commander of the whole group, and usually, I mean, it is mainly the same guys that are the sergeant, so I guess there is okay. some significance there.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, cool, man, and if somebody's actually interested in getting started doing this rather than just seeing it, what would you kind of advise them to do?
I would advise them to go to an event, talk to the guys. Almost every group has loaner gear or some type of, you know, clothing that they can hook you up and get you started. See if you like it. I mean, it is a little bit of an expensive hobby, getting all the equipment first. Once you have all the equipment, you know, you don't have to buy anything anymore. It's kind of, you show up for the weekend, that's it. But getting the equipment, you know, could be really expensive. Some of the musket alone is, you know, almost $1,500.
So are they basically real muskets that you just don't load with a ball?
They are real muskets. They're replicas. I have mine is a Petrosoli Brown Bess, and it fires live rounds. We fired them live rounds before.
Cool. Very cool, man. Well, hey, it sounds like an interesting hobby, and it sounds like there's a lot to be gained from community camaraderie and skill development in it. And I appreciate you being on the show with us today.
Oh, thank you.
All right, folks, and with that, this has been Jack Spirico today along with Sam Sampson, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. We'll be right back.
to forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Revolution is